Sirs, start your engines!
Hit the pace car! What for? Because you hit every other damn thing out there, I want you to be perfect!
When I'm driving, I got a guy on the radio who talks to me. You can see him. He talks to me.
He didn't slam you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbing son is racing.
Hey race fans, welcome to the Hoobazoo Radio Network and welcome to Drafting the Circuits. My name is Frank Santoroski. I'll be your host for the next hour as we discuss a action-packed weekend of racing that we just had here. With me in the studio tonight is Mr. Richard Uden, race engineer, and Mr. Seth Eggert, the NASCAR correspondent at Motor Sports Tribune. How are you gentlemen this evening?
Doing good.
Very good.
All right. Well, great to have you here both. So we had NASCAR at Daytona, the British Grand Prix this weekend, and IndyCar was on the 7/8 mile boring in Iowa. So we had three drastically different tracks and three really great races. But when I look at everything, I have to give Eric Jones the award for the best post-race comment when he said, "How about that race, boys and girls?" But, you know, that being said, great win for Eric Jones. We haven't had a first-time winner in NASCAR since Stenhouse last year. Is that correct, Seth?
Austin Dillon,
actually.
Okay, I thought he had won at Charlotte.
He won at Charlotte, but Stenhouse won at Talladega, which was before Charlotte.
Okay, so either way, you know, Eric Jones is a new winner in the series. So the other winners on the week were Sebastian Vettel winning in Great Britain and James Hinchcliffe taking a very popular win in Iowa. Hinchcliffe, whose season was a little derailed after being the guy bumped out of the Indy 500, needed some positive mojo, and he got that in grand fashion at Iowa. So great job to Jones, Hinch, and to Vettel. So before we get into dissecting the races, let's talk about some of the news items that we have out there. It came out earlier today that Harding Racing in the IndyCar Series is going to sit Gabby Chavez down in order to put Connor Daly in the car for the Grand Prix of Toronto in a attempt to evaluate him as a driver for 2019. As I look at this, it's a little bit of a raw deal for Gabby, who's the guy has a great work ethic. He got the shaft once before when he was Brian Herta's full-time driver his rookie season. Then the Herta team folded. Andretti merged with the Herta team. Everybody kept their job except poor old Gabby Chavez. He had a partial season in between. Harding picked him up for a full season. Harding says they're committed to him as their driver for 2019, but they do want to expand to a two-car effort. But it would appear that they lack the resources to do any testing or whatnot, or to enter a second car at the time, so their solution is to put Connor in the car and have Gabby sit on the sidelines. Now, Brian Barnhart, who's the race director over there at, or the managing director over there at Harding, used the words that Gabby was understandably pissed, as he probably should be. But it's a lot of folks like Connor Daly. He's popular with fans. He's not so popular with the race engineers and team owners. He's burned a couple bridges here and there, but he's getting another shot. Perhaps this will, materialize into a 2019 ride for Connor Daly. And again, I think that his personality, him being a, you know, an American from Indiana, his pedigree, being the son of a, you know, Formula One IndyCar driver, Derek Daly, is, it plays well. Hopefully he'll perform well. But, you know, on another side note, they're also looking at Pato O'Ward, who had a seat fitting with Harding. They're looking at Santa Eurytica, and they're also looking at Colton Herta for that second car next year. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that they may ask Gabby to sit another one out before the year is up. So now, Richard, you've worked within a team. You've seen these driver evaluation things. What are some of your thoughts on this whole thing and how it's transpired? Good deal, bad deal, best for the team, bad for Gabby. What are your thoughts?
It's a difficult. I mean, obviously, you know, your first thought is with the guy that's been, you know, has his nose put out of place really by being told to sort of sit on the bench for at least 1 week, potentially more. It's difficult. You know, these guys, they're racing drivers, and that is all they know how to do. You know, most of these kids sort of, you know, I'm not being disrespectful to them, don't have like a, you know, college education or, you know, a vocational background. All they know how to do is race cars, and that's all they want to do. So to be told, oh, you know, you're missing a race, you know, for 1 week, to, you know, we'll think, oh, that's not too bad. To these guys, it's like the end of the world. You know, the sky's falling in on them. Is this a good situation? I mean, what are you going to learn from putting a kid in, you know, for 1 week? There's no benchmark there. You know, you don't know how your regular driver's going to do in comparison. You know, you could get a complete lemon of the setup on the car and miss it by half a second a lap, and, you know, you don't really learn anything. You know, this guy's no good. Well, yeah, the setup's not good. I think if you're going to do these things, you know, it needs to be done in a, you know, a controlled environment, at a proper track test. Or, I mean, these days, you know, I don't know which, Harding, which engine manufacturer do they use?
They're a Chevrolet team.
Chevrolet. So Chevrolet have got at least two vehicle simulators in the US, which I know... Or no, I don't know for certain, but I'm pretty confident that the agreement is with most teams that if you are a Chevrolet partner, then you do get at least some time in the simulators as part of your agreement. So there is that time that would be available to them. You know, these simulators are very, very good these days. So you'd get 90% of an answer from just doing work in the simulator. So I think there's a little bit more to it than just, oh, we're evaluating, you know, these drivers for a second car next year. Something else a little bit there, I think, if you ask me.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder because at the same time they're saying that he's under contract for 2019 to be their driver. I don't know if they're just, you know, telling him, you know, and the good news is, you know, on a side note, what had happened was, you know, I don't know what they're trying to tell him there, but you know, sit out this week and let's see how Connor does. And again, as you say, yeah, there's really no benchmark for a first year team. They don't have data from that track last year. Last year they raced a couple of oval races, and this is their first. So we'll just have to see how it plays out.
And
I feel,
you know,
go ahead.
What happens if this guy goes out and finishes fifth? You know, does that make, you know, the current driver look useless, or, you know, where it doesn't really sit particularly well with me, but I'm not a team owner, so
yeah. Well, it's got to be absolutely scary sitting there, you know, wondering, yeah, what if this guy goes out here and really impresses? You know, is that the end of me?
Yeah.
And again, you know, Gabby has shown his mettle as being a pretty focused, a pretty tough guy. He's got a great work ethic. You know, he got to ride with the Herta team a couple of years ago based on winning the Indy Lights Championship. And, you know, and he's with his new team, and now he has to sit in the sidelines and just sweat it out. So, but we'll see. We'll see.
I mean, the worst thing a new team can do is swap and change drivers. If you're a new team with new engineers and new drivers and a new manager, you know, the most important thing is consistency and sticking with the same drivers and learning as a group. If you start pointing fingers and saying, well, this guy's better than that guy, then you're never going to get anywhere.
Exactly, exactly. So we'll see how all that plays out. Hopefully Gabby will be back in the car, you know, for Mid-Ohio and the rest of the season. But like I said, they gave Pat Award a seat fitting. You know, could that be just for a manufacturer test, or are they looking at putting him in the car? So all up in the air. All up in the air. Exactly, yeah. So, but, you know, that being aside, the other thing is the McLaren will they or won't they rumors have gotten some real, because we had a little shakeup in the management of McLaren. Who's the guy that resigned?
Eric Boullier.
Eric Boullier resigned, and then Joe Sauer, who's a...
that's resigned in air quotations.
Right, yeah, so he's no longer with McLaren, right? So, and so the quick speculation was that they're gonna trash the IndyCar program. They're not going to do it. And that came from Joe Sauer, who's a UK-based reporter who's heavily involved in Formula One, but he's really not, doesn't have his finger on the pulse of what's going on in IndyCar. Zach Brown was pretty quick to come back to say that rumors to that extent are crap. Now, the rumor that's crap is the rumor that they have decided not to come to IndyCar. At the same time, he said they have not decided that they will come to IndyCar. So, you know, but he's saying they haven't decided against it. They haven't decided before it, but they haven't decided against it. So it's still up in the air. We'll just have to see how that one plays out. But at the same time, Michael Andretti patiently waiting for a decision to see what he needs to do, if he's going to welcome a fifth car to a stable for McLaren with either Alonso or Dixon or whoever they choose to put in the car, or if it's going to be business as usual for him. So all that news aside, Seth, you've got some NASCAR news. We've got a driver making his Cup debut at Kentucky next week, where you and I will both be at the track.
Yes, Jesse Little, who is a part-time driver in the Truck Series, and he is the son of former driver Chad Little, who is currently one of the series directors. He will be making his Cup Series debut in the number 7 Premium Motorsports Chevrolet in Kentucky. We also have some sponsorship news. Kaz Grala will not be running the Xfinity Series race at Kentucky, unfortunately, due to a lack of sponsorship. And real quick on him, I do want to give a kudos to him for this past weekend. He finished 5th in the Fury Race Cars team in a 10-year-old Evernham chassis and a retired Stuart Haas Racing show car.
I read that. Yeah, it reminded me of the old story from the Indy 587 where they took the show car out of the hotel room in Allentown, out of the hotel lobby in Allentown, and gave it to Al Unser, and he won the race. So yeah, that's pretty neat. So, but again, it goes to show you, speaking of Daytona, you don't necessarily have to have the fastest car to win. You just need to survive the carnage. And at Daytona this past weekend, carnage there was for sure. And young Ricky Stenhouse, who was really good on restricted place last year, he was really good Saturday night. He was really aggressive, and he got a, you know, he was at fault for two of the bigger wrecks that took out some of the top contenders. Yeah, so Seth, I'll let you chime in on that.
Well, in total, he was in five accidents, three of his own making, which it's very ironic. His sponsor was Fifth Third Bank, so 5 wrecks, 3 he caused.
That's funny. That's funny.
And now, the one wreck I do want to, or there's 2 wrecks I want to draw attention to. One was the massive pileup that Stenhouse caused, the first big one of the night. He didn't check up when Keselowski did, and Keselowski had checked up for a block because of William Byron. That sent Keselowski, who was in third, up into Kurt Busch, who was in second, and they spun in front of the entire field. 26 cars in total were involved in that wreck in some way, shape, or form.
Now, the interesting thing is, yeah, Stenhouse got into Keselowski, right? But Keselowski, in his post-race, you know, post-crash interview, didn't seem so upset with Stenhouse as he was with Byron for the what he called a bad buck. And Keselowski said, I guess, what did he say? He said, like, I guess I don't wreck enough people that people think they can throw me a bad block. So, but, you know, wait till Talladega. You know, what are your thoughts there? I mean, is Stenhouse getting unfairly blamed for this when maybe it's Byron's fault?
Well, let's put it this way. Keselowski was the only person to blame Byron, and Stenhouse had a police escort back to the driver-owner motor coach lot.
Right. So to your point, you believe this is all Stenhouse. But I mean, was the block on Keselowski bad?
I'll say that it was too early in the race to be blocking like that. They were maybe 10 laps into the second stage. They still had another 30 or so to go in that stage, and they were well away from the halfway mark of the race, and they ended up wiping out over half the cars in the race.
And a lot of really good cars, too. You took out, I think, all the Penske cars went out there.
All three Penske cars.
Right. And then
you had half of Stuart Haas get taken out there. You had Chase Elliott get taken out. You had Austin Dillon get a piece of the wreck. You had Daniel Suarez get taken out. Denny Hamlin was in it. So just about half, if not all, of the powerhouse teams were taken out in that wreck. And then Stenhouse went and proceeded to wipe out Byron, Kyle Busch, Jamie McMurray, and Kyle Larson in the next incident.
Yep. You know, it's kind of funny because you talk about, you know, racers wanting a race. And I was reading something, I think maybe it was Robin Miller that wrote it, that it's just an unpleasant feeling. You're just wheeling it around, waiting for the big one, hoping you avoid it, and it's not, play racing is not real racing, although it is kind of exciting to watch. You know, I guess it's my guilty pleasure. Richard, what do you think? You've watched racing your whole life. Is this play racing real racing, or is it just manufactured drama? and the other thing I want to throw at you, have they made this new era package a bit too unstable, where if you're just a little bit off on the bump draft, you're causing a wreck? Because it used to be, you know, when I watched NASCAR in the 90s, you could do the bump draft and then the cars would not just immediately snap around like they do.
I think so the first part is this plate racing or restricted plate racing, you know, real racing. There is a skill to it. You know, you look at the guys that, you know, win plate races. There are certain drivers that are better than others. You know, Dale Jr. was a prime example, and his father, you know, they were great plate racers. They understood how to race these tracks. You know, I know a few guys that used to work at DAI back in the day when they were, like, I think they won like 6 out of 7 plate races or something in a row. And, you know, they would tune their cars and they would spend hours and hours and hours in the wind tunnel and on shaker rigs and doing vibration, you know, to eke out every last bit of potential power from the car. So there's certainly skill involved there from a engineering perspective. And there is certainly a skill set needed to be a competitive plate race driver. So, yeah, I think it is racing. Is it a pure form of racing? I think there's too much luck in it. I think that, you know, you need that little bit of control. And, again, we go back to this whole thing, and I keep banging on about this, you know, on this show quite regularly. When you're a team and when you're a driver and when you put in a huge amount of effort, you want a return on that effort. And you don't necessarily get that in plate racing because it is randomized to a great extent. So I think that's where they struggle, is the random nature of plate racing, you know, and how the big one can take so many cars out. You know, I think they... It's difficult. It's the nature of the beast, isn't it? But I think it is racing, and I think it is, you know, there is a skill set, and I haven't really answered the question at all there, have I?
Oh, that's okay, yeah. But at the same time, to your point, yeah, you've got guys that are great at plate racing, but plate races have produced some of the most unlikely winners just because the luck factor. And exactly. Eric Jones may be one of those there where he really wasn't in contention all day.
No, he was
up there, but he was able to make that pass stick at the end through how many overtimes? Two overtimes, right? But you got guys like Jimmy Spencer, Derek Cope, Trevor Bayne, who've just come out of nowhere to win a plate race.
Yeah.
Ricky Stenhouse. You know, who've got you know, good arrow and survive the carnage and pop up and win. So,
but you know, you look at, you know, this is another prime example. But you look back at the 500 in February there when Austin won, they were nowhere all weekend really. You know, even they actually went to a backup car in the middle of the week because the car they qualified in was so poor, and throughout the race, I don't think he was in the top five apart from the last lap in reality. So, you know, you've got to give it, you know, there is a skill to that without any doubt. But there's also a huge amount of luck.
Huge amount of luck. So, now, Seth, we had Xfinity on Friday night, and we had a little bit of controversy at the end there. Kyle Larson was declared the winner, although he did not cross the finish line first. NASCAR took a little heat for the call on the who was the gentleman who crossed the finish line
Justin
first?
Justin Haley.
Justin Haley had executed a pass below the double yellow, and NASCAR explained that yep, that's the rule. If you get two tires below that yellow, it's an illegal pass. If you improve your position, unless you're forced down there. So, I mean, there's a little gray area in the rule.
Well,
Seth, I'm going to let you...
Gray area this time.
I'm going to let you talk us through it.
Well, Justin Haley had swung from the outside up against the wall all the way down to the WL line. And he was straddling just above it while you had Elliott Sadler and Larson beating and banging, coming to the checkered. Haley gets beside him. As he's beside them, they start moving down the track. So he instinctively moved down and put his left side tires below the yellow line. He was making the pass, and yes, he was improving his position. However, there's actually some debate as to whether or not his bumper was ahead of the other two when he went below the yellow line. If it was ahead, he couldn't have improved his position, and therefore the penalty would have been null and void. However, NASCAR ruled that he was improving his position and penalized him. He went from leading the final lap and winning in just his second Xfinity Series start to finishing 18th. The last car on the lead lap.
All right, so now, Seth, let me ask you this. Do you personally agree or disagree with NASCAR's call?
Honestly, I disagree with it, and this is after listening to the debate when you have champions such as Brad Keselowski from the Cup Series, Tobaldine, who won championships in the Truck Series and is now a broadcaster, questioning that call as to whether or not it was the right call.
And Richard, your thoughts on that?
I haven't seen it.
Okay, so
I didn't see it during the race, and I saw everybody's comments before I saw the highlights, if you're with me. So I probably had a slightly loaded impression of it. But I don't think he had to go below the line like he had to, and the rules are the rules, and they're reiterated repeatedly. So I think it was the right call.
And that part, I will say, I agree with. The rules are the rules, and whether I like it or not, NASCAR has to be some at least consistent in enforcing the rules. So they went by the rule book. I understand it. I just don't like it.
No.
Well, I mean, they beat this in the drivers' heads all weekend long. Don't go below that double yellow line, you know, so.
I mean, you know, and also, we mentioned briefly off air before the start of the show, you know, this kid is, you know, to a great extent, that's what the spotters are there for, you know. They're there to, you know, to help these guys and say, you know, I'm sure. Give him a little point and say, hey, guys.
You know, it is what it is, and this young man has learned from his mistake, I'm sure. But, again, you know, the fact that here you got a guy in his second career Xfinity race.
Yes, he's a regular in the truck series.
Right, and there he is just about winning the race, perhaps winning the race. Thought he won the race because he was doing the donuts as at the same time Kyle Larson was. So, you know, lesson learned for him. But again, it just shows you that these plate races are unpredictable, and that, you know, it's the surprise winners pop up there out of nowhere.
And if I may, just one quick mention. Also in the Xfinity Series race, they had their own big one, and that one was after the end of the second stage. And Austin Cindric went for a barrel roll. He rolled about three times on the banking in turn one.
Yikes, I didn't see that.
He was okay. It took him a minute to get out of the car because of his height. So landing on the hard asphalt at an angle, it bent the roof in a little bit. So he just needed help getting out of the car simply because of his height.
Okay, but it's all well and good. He's uninjured. Yes. That's good to know. Good to know. So, all right, so NASCAR is off to Kentucky.
Yes.
This coming weekend. Seth, you and I will both be at the racetrack. And Richard, you're flying.
I didn't get my invite. Thanks, guys. Jeez. That's awkward, isn't it? Yeah. Wow.
Richard, you're always invited. So. Kentucky, they've been promoting the heck out of this race with the turn three at Kentucky. Turn three at Kentucky is the toughest turn in NASCAR. What do you think about this, Seth? Is turn three at Kentucky the toughest turn in NASCAR?
No, and I do want to mention one thing. They're promoting it as turn three being the issue. Meanwhile, half the promo is people wrecking coming out of turn two.
Yeah, so. But and anyway, when they repaved the track, they reprofiled turns one and two, but they kept three and four rather similar to what they were. So, but anyway, I mean, I was out there last year. I enjoyed the race. It was Kyle Busch and Martin Truex show. Martin Truex took the win at the end of the day. Again, I think that they've done a pretty nice job reprofiling the track, so it's not what they call a cookie cutter 1.5 mile oval. It used to have pretty much the same profile as, you know, Texas, Charlotte, all the rest of them. But now they've done a nice job with giving the track a little character. And if they want to promote the turn three as the toughest turn in NASCAR, yeah, you know, that's all well and good. We'll see what happens. I think, Seth, I've got us some grandstand seats that we get out of the media center, and they're going to be with a good turn of a good view of turn three. So we'll see how all that plays out. But that being said, I mean, who do you like for Kentucky? Kentucky has exactly three different people winning at the track, and that's Brad, Martin, and Kyle.
I'm going to say Kevin Harvick.
Sure, why not? And Richard, you like anybody for Kentucky?
Let's have a think. Harvick's the obvious choice, isn't it? Who could look good around there?
No, Harvick's not the obvious choice.
Well, He's got the momentum, hasn't he? You know, he probably should or could have won Sonoma. You know, he dropped off a little bit of Chicago, didn't he? Let's go with Kyle Larson.
Okay, that's a good pick there. Yeah, Kyle had a pretty good. I want to say Kyle had a pretty good run there last year. I remember the first year I went to the NASCAR race in Kentucky, Kyle Larson was the guy that smacked the wall so hard in the back, on the back, coming out of two, that it sounded like a gunshot sitting in turn four. Yeah, so, but yeah, I've got to go with Keselowski at Kentucky. He's had a great run there. I think he's won. Is it three times, Seth, or?
I think it's three. I'm just double-checking to make sure.
I want to say he has three. Kyle's got two, and Martin's got one, I believe.
Yeah, it's three. Kyle has two, Martin has one, and Matt Kenseth has one.
Oh, that's right. Kenseth won that one year, yeah. So, but I'm going to go with Brad. Brad needs a win. Brad had a really good – he had a really fast car at Daytona. And probably could have won that if it weren't for, Stenhouse or Byron, depends on who you believe. So.
And just one more note to Richard, Chevrolet has not won in the Cup Series at Kentucky.
Well, there you go. Hey, records are there to be broken.
Actually, Kentucky last year, all three races, Truck, Xfinity, and Cup, were swept by Toyota cars. And they have been...
In the triple header weekend, yes.
Yes, yes. And I live here in Kentucky, so they have been promoting the heck of that on local radio. They say, you know, Toyota's returning to see if they can do this streak again of all three. So, and just so you know, Toyotas are built in Georgetown, Kentucky, which is somewhere right in between where I live in Kentucky and the Speedway. And they're one of the finest employers in the state, and the Camry is built right here in Kentucky. So they're very proud of the fact that last year Toyota cars and trucks swept all three races. So it'll be great to see. And Seth, I'm looking forward to seeing you at the racetrack this weekend. So before we stop off of talking about NASCAR and move on to IndyCar and Formula One, do we have any dangling NASCAR news we need to talk about, Seth?
Brett Moffitt will have a sponsor at Eldora Speedway. He and his team will be sponsored by iRacing.com. And that was a team that is in contention for a championship. Moffitt has won three truck races, and it was looking like Eldora, Bristol, and Homestead were going to be issues with sponsorship that they may not be able to compete. They have a sponsor for Homestead. They haven't announced it yet, and they just announced iRacing for Eldora. Now the only race they need sponsorship for is Bristol.
All right, well, good for them. Good for iRacing hopping on board and sponsoring real cars instead of your simulator ones. So,
and one other note about simulators and Eldora. Ryan Newman will run the Eldora truck race in the number 3 VRX Racing Simulators Chevrolet Silverado for Jordan Anderson.
Now, Richard, you've worked with Ryan Newman a little bit. Has he done any simulator time, or is this just slapping the name on the car?
Ryan's one of the old school. He's not a big fan of these newfangled simulators and all that sort of stuff, so... I think it's more of a PR exercise than his personal way that he prepares for races. Let's put it that way. But you never know. Maybe this could be the race that inspires him to get into the simulator and put some miles in them. They're certainly new technology, and there's a lot to be gained from using those.
And I will say, it's interesting that Jordan Anderson is taking a step back from being a driver owner to having a driver basically replace himself. But not only that, he reached out and got Ryan Newman, the caliber of driver he is, especially on dirt. He ran the first Eldora Dirt Derby and finished third. That was the last time he competed in the Truck Series back in 2013.
Oh, no, I'm going to hold you up to that one. He raced a truck at Kansas in 2015 or 16, I think. I'm almost certain he did. I'm almost certain he did, because it would have been 2015 Kansas, Newman drove a truck. So I'm sure Wikipedia will clear that up for us.
I'm sure. Well, I wish you worked with the guy, so yeah, you're probably right.
I just want to get one over on Seth with the NASCAR stat. I'll dine on that for the rest of the year.
He did announce for Newman check. But I will say this. I went based on the press release.
It's a press release.
All right.
I've seen press releases on about drivers getting pole position, or not pole position, but qualifying first at a race that they weren't even in the same country at that time when the qualifying took place. So that wouldn't mean read much on press releases. Anyway, moving on.
Anyway, yeah, press releases are written by guys like me and Seth. So, but anyway, speaking of stuff that you can get over on Seth, Richard, let's talk about the British Grand Prix. And that's where, I know you, when you were a young person growing up in Great Britain, you've been to the Silverstone track many times.
I have.
You enjoyed that as a kid, and it's one of the iconic classic tracks that's still there, you know, in the midst of all these newer tracks in these Far East countries and whatnot. But Silverstone is still there, still puts on a good race, and man, Formula One put on a great show this weekend. You know, with actual passes on the track and passes in anger, and you know, a little bit of bumping and banging almost. So at the end of the day, it was Sebastian Vettel who maintains the points lead. Lewis Hamilton, who everybody there, I think 260,000 people is what they said were there for the weekend, which is huge. It's huge. You know, and Hamilton has won the last couple of years there. So, hey, he didn't win today. So let's talk through this British Grand Prix.
So yeah, we'd come back from, you know, as Hamilton dramatically called the worst weekend of his career in Austria, where Mercedes suffered a double DNF, and there was a lot of expectation on them going into Silverstone. You know, their base is Brackley for the chassis side, which is probably 15 miles from Silverstone in one direction, and the Mercedes engine facility at Brixworth, which is probably 20, 30 miles in the opposite direction. So this is their home track in many, many ways. And you expect them to go there and be strong and be competitive and really sort of take the fight back to Ferrari and try and wrestle that championship lead back from them. And as we saw in Austria throughout Friday and Saturday, up until qualifying, admittedly, Vettel did steal second practice, I think. But all in all, you know, the Mercedes looked pretty dominant. And then Hamilton got pole in qualifying by a pretty close margin. Again, people expected them to have, you know, a 2 or 3 tenths of a second gap over Ferrari. And it was in the hundredths of a second gap. Ferrari bought some modifications to the car, a new floor, I believe, which some people were saying was almost half a second's worth of, 2 tenths of a second's worth of performance, which is a huge performance step from any one individual component. Slightly unusual for Silverstone, and I can, you know, if this is coming from personal experience, it was incredibly hot there at the weekend. Normally it's its own microclimate, and it's just above freezing, even in July. But it was a hot day, and a lot of teams weren't really expecting that. So again, for, you know, second or third race in a row, you see off the start line there, Mercedes have a poor start, coupled with Ferrari having a fantastic start, puts the two Mercedes cars on the back foot. Vettel gets ahead of Hamilton, which puts him out of position between turn one and two, which allows Bottas to get past him. So coming into turn three, you know, Hamilton's back in third place, and Raikkonen's in fourth. Now, Raikkonen by his own admission, made a mistake, locked his front right, I believe, front left, and collided with Hamilton. And it was a genuine mistake in many, many ways. And, you know, Raikkonen even admitted post-race that that was the case. Dropped Lewis to the back of the pack, and, you know, he started to drive through. You saw him, I think he probably got us about fifth or sixth through a pit stop cycle when Marcus Ericsson had a DRS issue going into the very fast turn one kink. I think it was Red Bull could take turn one flat out with DRS open. Most of the other cars had to sort of close DRS through turn one and then open it again on the exit. And Ericsson just said he got the timing of it wrong. And, you know, it had a pretty big impact with the wall in turn one. It looked a little bit worse on TV because where he'd actually impacted, there was a bit of a recess in the tyres, and it looked like he'd sort of gone, you know, three quarters of the way into the tyre barrier. But thankfully, Marcus was okay. Got out of the car. That brought up the safety car. Now, that allowed Ferrari to pit Vettel and save his tyres so he could get to the end of the race without really any concerns on degradation. They left Valtteri out and they left Hamilton out, which sort of shuffled the pack a little bit and put Valtteri in the lead. Vettel was second, and then Hamilton came in third, I believe, on the restart there. Excuse me. Then halfway through the first lap post restart, you saw Carlos Sainz and I believe it was Romain Grosjean came together into the very fast right hand at Copse, which was the old turn one back in the day. Carlos Sainz was incredibly lucky he didn't roll the car. They got airborne, and he was lucky that he landed the right way up there. That brought out a second safety car, which, in my opinion, I don't think was warranted. I think they could have got away with the virtual safety car. Then I understand the reason for the first safety car was because Ericsson's crash on the cars. They have a sensor which detects impacts above a certain deceleration rate, and if that light is illuminated on the nose of the car, then the driver needs to have medical assessment. And the best way for them to do that is to get, you know, a medical car out there and get the driver looked at straight away. So I totally understand that. Whereas, you know, for those two guys, I don't think that was the case there, and they just walked off. So I think they could have got away with the virtual safety car there. The resulting factor there was that Hamilton ended up being on tyres that could get him through to the end of the race, which were about eight or nine laps newer than Bottas's tyres. But unfortunately, on the restart, Bottas was really struggling with his tyres, which allowed Vettel to pass him and take the lead. Then Hamilton and Raikkonen both passed Bottas before the end of the race, and Hamilton wasn't really in a position to press Vettel. So you ended up Vettel winning with Hamilton in second and Raikkonen in third. Pretty unusual, you know, an unexpected result, because Silverstone's been a bogey track for Ferrari for many, many years now. And, you know, they pulled that out of the bag there. And people will look at Raikkonen hitting Hamilton. But, you know, at the end of the day, Hamilton made a bad start. You can say what you want about it. It was a bad start. And best, even if Raikkonen hadn't hit him, he would have been third going, you know, out of the first complex of corners there. So Vettel would have still taken some beating from that position. Yeah, it was great to watch for the fans to see Hamilton battle back through the field, but you expected it. I mean, that car's 2 or 3 seconds, at least 1 to 2 seconds faster than most of the cars out there. So it wasn't a surprise that he did cut through to get into that top six place. When he got behind the Red Bulls, it was harder for him to make an impression on those guys.
So, Richard, let me ask you this while we're talking about the Mercedes, and they've had a, you know, double retirement last week, and then they, you know, had their issues this week. Do you think Mercedes is still a lock for this title, or do you think Vettel can you know, he's leading the points. Do you think Ferrari can hold on through the rest of the season? I know we've got the rest of the European season, then the break is coming up. Do you think that Ferrari really has a shot at this thing, or is just Mercedes just going to trounce the rest of the year?
Well, you know what? Before Silverstone, I would have said, you know, at some point Mercedes is going to get the finger out and they're going to do this. Silverstone is a power track, 100%. And I think it's 80% full throttle, I think, or some crazy number like that. And you look at Ferrari, and they went toe-to-toe with them in qualifying. You know, they were within a blink of an eye between those two cars. So I think there's a potential there that you know, Ferrari can push Mercedes. And if Lewis keeps making mistakes and, you know, the pressure gets put on the team. Now, I do want to say one thing. People criticise Mercedes for the mistakes they made in Austria, and the retirement sort of compounded that, but the strategy mistakes they made. The strategy calls they made at Silverstone got Hamilton that second place when they kept him out at the first safety car. If Hamilton had pitted at that first safety car with the, you know, the Ferraris and the Red Bulls, he would have probably finished fourth or fifth. So they certainly made him positions there. So the strategy there was perfect. So credit where credit's due on that position. But it'll be interesting to see. I think that, you know, the person that's going to beat, you know, the person that's going to lose the championship is Hamilton. I think he's going to get to him in his head. I think the way he reacted post-race at Silverstone by not talking to the TV interview in Parc Fermé was disgraceful. You know, he needs to step up and do what he's paid handsomely to do in front of 100,000 plus people who pay a significant amount of money to go and watch that race. He needs to stop acting like a spoilt child, unfortunately. I think that'll be the thing that'll cost him this championship, is his own mental state.
I mean, let's be honest here, though. Like Lewis Hamilton was P3 before Raikkonen hit him. I mean, in a way, yeah. Raikkonen helped him, right? Because otherwise...
I mean, as I said earlier, if Raikkonen hadn't hit him, Hamilton wouldn't have finished any better than the second.
Yeah, I look at that little comment you made, though, about Hamilton and kind of the mental toughness in some capacity. It's interesting to me because I'm looking at this from a standpoint of how are we going to be when the summer break hits? Because I look at last year, and I remember that Vettel was the hot shoe going into the summer break, and I remember that Vettel started to weaken shortly thereafter in the summer break because all the updates and everything that transpired after it. So are you sure we're not just running into a situation where maybe we're just replaying the same story from last year a little bit?
Well, I totally get where you're coming from with that. But, you know, the majority of performance here is in the car development. And as there's been a reasonably static regulation change for the last few, you know, static regulations for the last few years, the gains that teams can make from any one upgrade are limited. Now, bearing in mind Ferrari did bring a, you know, this new floor to Silverstone, which apparently had a huge impact on it. So, you know, there are still gains to be found, but it's as a series sort of plateaus with its regulation changes, it does tend more and more to go down the drivers. Now, last year, post-summer break, it was Hamilton that stepped up and really sort of started to dominate the championship. And then, of course, you know, they had the events of Singapore where the two Ferraris took each other out in the rain, which really did, you know, swing it Hamilton's way. So if Ferrari can avoid those capitulations and Mercedes don't find a huge amount of speed, then I think it's Hamilton that's starting to show the crack. I mean, when was he really in a tight championship fight?
It's been a while.
It was Rosberg, and he cracked. Yeah. You know, it was Hamilton that made the mistakes, and it was his engineers that made the mistakes. So
I look at it from a standpoint, too, though. When I look at Hamilton, it's also, we all know Hamilton's personality. We all know that he's got to be a guy that's doing a lot of different things. He likes to be in a lot of different things. And Vettel is one of those guys that's just squarely locked in on Formula One. Now, sometimes you can look at that and say, well, that means Hamilton's always refreshed and ready to go. You could also look at it where Vettel is just absorbing way too much and exhausting himself, and he's going to be just well put out by the time we get past the summer break. But then the other flip side of that is, you know, Hamilton's not mentally always into it. And I feel like, to your point, the further we go into the career of Lewis Hamilton, the further we see, or the more often we see, I should say, how he just doesn't show up sometimes on a race weekend.
Yeah.
Where he just becomes pretty much a ghost. I mean, and for all intents and purposes, in Russia, we all knew it should have been Valtteri that took that, and it was a lucky break for Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Whereas you look at the other end of that, I mean, we look at this one, and I hate to throw Valtteri under the bus again because he's been driving great. He's been on the back foot of things. The tires weren't there for him in Silverstone, but the problem was is the second he was passed with that and that aero wash got a hold of that car, he just couldn't go anywhere after he fell to second, and that's why he fell out of the podium. And unfortunately, it looks really good for Hamilton because it looks like Hamilton is just taking Bottas to the curb, but at the same token, Bottas is out very handedly outdriven. Hamilton just not got the brakes. Hamilton's been out to lunch more than one occasion this season, and I think, to your point, that's going to bite him at the end of the year. I really do think this is Vettel's title to lose.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about this title this year is that it looks like it's becoming down between Vettel and Hamilton, which whoever wins this is going to be a five-time champion. And for years and years and years, the only five-time champion was Fangio, who won in the 50s. Then nobody won more than three for years and years and years. And, you know, Prost won four. And then, of course, Michael Schumacher obliterated every record in Formula One with his seven titles. But we haven't seen another person get five championships. And we will see that this year, barring, you know, the odd fact that, you know, Valtteri or Max Verstappen sneaks in and wins this thing, which I don't see happening. So, that historically, this is a pretty neat season to see these guys fighting for five. You know, you got four apiece. So, but
it would be more humorous to see Danny Ric just come in there after being slighted at Red Bull and win a title. Just saying.
Yeah, but he's a little farther back, but it's not totally out of the question. You know, there's a lot of season left, so. But I do want to. We got about 10 minutes left in the show, and excuse me, Joey Barnes has joined us. Joey Barnes, who writes for IndyCar.com, and wrote a really neat article earlier this week, or earlier today, about the World Cup in soccer and IndyCar drivers' reaction to that. So, which is pretty neat. So check that out on IndyCar.com. But, Joey, you spent your weekend in Iowa, and I really enjoyed the Iowa race. I thought that IndyCar got the aero package right. We had two lanes and sometimes three lanes for racing. There were nearly 1,000 passes, 955, I believe. Only three for the lead, you know, Newgarden on power and then Hinchcliffe on Newgarden. And just they really nailed this. They've got this new car working well on the ovals, but the finish under yellow left a sour taste in a lot of fans' mouths. So what are your thoughts on that finish under yellow and the fact that Newgarden and Wickens – went to pit anticipating a green that they didn't get and just lost track position?
I feel like, man, this is going to be interesting. First and foremost, the finish under yellow. Let's attack that first. I think that we all want to see a shootout for the win, right? But I don't want to see it in a NASCAR fashion. I mean, goodness gracious, they put millions and millions of dollars of wrecked race cars up on the trailers after Saturday night's race.
Oh, but yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So I'm thankful and lives at risk at that account. And I look at this situation on the IndyCar side of it, and I understand that it may not be popular because, oh, we always want to see a shootout. But, A, the allotted amount is 300 laps, and then, B, we're not tearing up a bunch of equipment and putting a bunch of mechanics and engineers who, you know, let's be honest, they work well below what they are deserved These mechanics definitely deserve way more than what they're getting right now. And to put them even further in the hole, especially after what's been an incredibly tough rough stretch from St. Petersburg to now with how much testing and how many races have gone on, I think it's important that you keep them happy. And so, not popular, but when's the last time that we really had a yellow finish in an IndyCar race? It's been a minute. So I think that, especially on an oval, so I think that, you know what, I understand those things happen. I understand they're not popular. Keeping the sporting side of this in perspective, it went the distance, everybody went home safe, and you know what? There's 380-something passes last year for the entire race, and we had almost 1,000 this year. One guy dominated majority of it. You know what? A couple years ago, that same guy dominated it in the old package, too. So I can't hear anybody mouth off comparisons and say, we wish this, we wish that. At the end of the day, this was a good race. And to go to the part that you want to talk about, which is the drivers that pitted, Spencer Piggott, Robert Wickens and Joseph Newgarden and them. It took 10 laps to clean up a Zach Veach scrubbing the wall in four earlier, and our only other caution. So common sense would have told me that it's going to take a little bit of time since we saw Ed Carpenter get a little loose, almost take out Takuma in the process, but there was some debris on the track, and it would tell me, common sense would, that, well, if it took them 10 laps to do that, and we're on lap, what was that, 294 when that caution came out?
Yep.
Common sense would tell me that we're probably not going to get this thing rolling again. On the plus side, there's five guys on the lead lap, right?
Yeah, so, you're not going to lose too much, are you?
Yeah, so you're not losing a lot, unfortunately, for Wickens and Newgarden. They lost a podium, but that's where Piggott and Sato were smart in the regard of, you know, hey, if it took 10 laps to do that, we're only on track for six. This kind of just seems like a no-brainer. Plus, if you jump me with fresh tires off a one-lap start, more power to you, because I'm just finishing right back where I was anyway. So they had everything to gain and nothing to lose, and it's always tougher the further front of the field you go, the tougher it is to make that call to come down pit road or not. I know that they wanted to get it refired. They wanted to get the race restarted and get that one- or two-lap shootout, but, you know, when you've got the situation that plays out the way that it did with trying to pick up debris, getting the track cleaned up, having to reorder the cars so your lead lap cars are in front of the lap cars, but you've got almost 20 cars a lap or more down, there's a lot of shuffling that goes on from race control. So there's a lot of variables that played into that. But it shouldn't take away from what was a good show. I understand the ending maybe wasn't desired, but it was a pretty damn good show in my opinion.
Oh, it was a very good show, yeah. But I mean, if you look back to the Indy 500 in 14, when Hunter Ray won, and they did that quick red flag to stop everybody just so we could have two more laps, they possibly could have done that just to go ahead and, you know, just get two more laps under, you know, and finish under. I think Hinch would have won either way. There wasn't enough time for Newgarden or Wickens with the fresh tires to burn through the field like Hunter Ray did a couple of years ago at Iowa, where he took the fresh tires on. And
I don't know. There was a big gap, though, when you look at somebody that was on 40, 50, 60, 70 lap old tires versus fresh tires. I mean, there was a good anywhere between a 3 and 8 tenths of a second difference when you're looking at that kind of tire deg.
Yeah, but if you only had two laps to do it, so I don't know. Hey. The world will never know because we entered under yellow, as we do in IndyCar. We don't have a, you know, green white checker. You know, if IndyCar wanted to do a green white checker, they'd have to look at fuel allotments.
No, I agree.
No. But I'm just telling what I read on social media comments. So, but on a plus side, James Hinchcliffe. Great win for him. The guy was totally, you know, defeated, you know, being the guy bumped at Indy. Missed the 500. Needed some sort of positive mojo to get his season going on. Wins in Iowa. Next week, they're in his hometown, racing in Toronto. which is the race he went to as a little kid that really sparked his interest in racing. So we've got about a minute left in the show, so we've got to go around the table and get a pick for Toronto, and then we got to go back around and get a pick for Germany for the Formula One race. So, Joey, who do you like for Toronto?
Oh man, that's a tough call. I'll probably go Will Power.
Okay, Seth, who do you like for Toronto?
Robert Wickens.
No.
And so Richard, I gather you like Robert Wickens for Toronto?
Every damn week somebody does this to me.
All right, so who do you like for Toronto?
I was going to say Robert Wickens. I'll give my buddy Takuma. He's going to pull one out of the bag.
Hey, Frank, how come you never let Richard pick first?
Because it's so entertaining when somebody takes his pick. You just heard that, yeah, so... I'm gonna go with Rossi. I think the Toronto track fits Rossi's style. So, and then we got to go back around one more time for Germany
because Formula One. Germany.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
and we just did a triple header. You want them to do a quad header? Oh my goodness!
Oh my goodness! I thought Germany was this week. So,
and what? Very quickly, we got a little bit of time for some Formula One news. So. All this, messing around with new engine regulations for 2021, it looks like it's going to stay as it is, pretty much, because all the current manufacturers have said, well, the reasons we wanted to change it was to invite new manufacturers into the sport to make it cheaper for them to be involved. All the companies that have been talking with Formula One about coming in for 2021, nobody's committed to it yet. So the teams have turned around and said, well, hey, look, if you're not going to commit, we're going to stick with what we've got. And... yeah, so that's the Formula One news at the moment. All very silly.
All very silly. So with that being said, we are right up at the end of the hour. So I want to say thank you, Richard and Seth. And I want to thank you, Joey, for all coming on the show. I want to thank the Hoobazoo Radio Network and iHeartRadio. And I want to thank all you folks that tune in and listen to us week in and week out talk about the race. And so until then, good night.
WHOOBAZOO.com. WHOOBAZOO.com. Enter website.